You're listening to a talk by David Ray Griffin on 9/11 Contradictions, an open letter to Congress and the press, given in Montreal in June. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We return for the conclusion of Professor Griffin's talk.
When you get to the Misali report, now this is just beyond belief. You get to the Misali report, the FBI turned down. It does mention Barbara Olson when it gets to Flight 77. And here's what it says. Barbara Olson, one attempted call, unconnected, 0 seconds. Now Ted had said she called twice, they talked for about a minute each time. Should this have not have been a screening headline in all of our newspapers? FBI says story told by former Department of Justice Solicitor General. See, the FBI is part of the Department of Justice. So here's the FBI saying that the former head guy, second head guy, his story, it's not true. It didn't happen. Have you seen the new video by the Freebies?
Right.
Take off on the Bee Gees, Staying Alive, and it's called 9/11's Lie, and it's just really well done. Well, I had said this when we were over in European Parliament screening this new film put out by the Italian member of European Parliament, Chiesa, Giolitto Chiesa, and evidently they saw that because it got on YouTube, and I had said, and so in that film, there's the Washington Post with the screaming headline about FBI says former. So I was very happy about that. Sometimes something you do makes a little difference. So isn't this very, very strange? So you just, you know, you launch a worldwide war on terror. I mean, we're talking serious stuff here about 6 to 7 million people in Afghanistan have died because of the invasion, you know, between starvation and all sorts of reasons. That's what you go on, some of the counts are. In Iraq, probably the best count is 1.2 million Iraqis, civilians, who have died. So we're talking about very serious stuff. This war was launched in large part on the basis of Barbara Olson's call. You know, she was this very well-known commentator on CNN, and she was beloved by the right, because she was always attacking Hillary Clinton. And, you know, they really hated Hillary in those days. They like her a little bit now. But she was very, very well-known. So the idea that these Muslims had killed sweet, blonde Barbara. I mean, I mean to focus on the race and racial implications here. So many people said they signed up for the war in Iraq to get even with the Iraqis for 9/11. Now, you know, they've admitted now no evidence whatsoever that Saddam was involved. But they sold that with innuendo and sometimes coming right out saying it, that Saddam was involved. It was a ludicrous idea that he would be involved with Osama bin Laden, but they sold it. And now, after all of that, they just turn around and say, that didn't really happen. And we're just supposed to not say a word. And thus far, our mainstream media has not said a word. That was 2006, this was published. Okay. All the other evidence was fabricated too. You know, all the photographs of them in airports. There was there were passports that were found at the crash sites. Now, again, if it weren't so tragic, it would be hilarious. World Trade Center. So the idea was they told us this passport of Tsukami, who was on Flight 11, the one that hit the North Tower, supposedly. They found it the next day under, Ground Zero. So imagine this. You've got your passport in your pocket. You fly into a building. There's this huge fireball. And then the building, an hour or hour and a half, about the night, 101 minutes later, collapses. And everything is pulverized. The computers, the desk, everything except the steel is pulverized into dust. But Tsukami's passport is found. Now, the press did say something here. One British paper said, even the most fervent believer in the war on terror would have to question the feasibility of this. And so they changed the story. And they said, actually, they found it before the North Tower collapsed. So really, all it had to do was somehow pop out of the airplane and survive the fire and float down to the ground. Flight 93. Everybody gets to the crash site and says, where's the plane? There's no plane. The official story was that the hijackers, when the heroic passengers tried to take over the flight, turned the plane down, so they were going down at 45 degrees at 580 miles an hour. And they hit that soft Pennsylvania soil, and the plane went clear into the ground so that not even the tail was showing. I'm not making this up. Somebody's making it up, but it's not me. Except they found the pilot's passport. And they found one of these red bandanas, absolutely clean, on the ground. It's true. It's true. He's incredulous. When people talk about don't believe loony conspiracy theories about 9/11, the most decisive evidence was Otto's luggage. You know the story. It's on the first page of, some of you know the story, it's on the first page of the 9/11 Commission report. Talk about Otta and a guy named Al Omari. Now, this is very strange, because Otta never went anywhere without Marwan al-Shehhi, who was probably his bodyguard. But somehow on this trip, he went with a different guy. And so that's suspicious in and of itself. But anyway, that was the story, that Otto was already in Boston, and Otto is the purported pilot of Flight 11, so it's pretty important that he be there on the morning of Flight 11, of September 11th, to get on Flight 11. And he was already in Boston on the 10th. Nevertheless, he rented a car, a blue Nissan, and he and Almari drove up to Portland, Maine, stayed overnight, Comfort Inn, and then got up very early the next morning to catch the commuter flight that left at 6 o'clock back down to Boston. Now, what if that commuter flight had been 45 minutes late? Otto was not only the pilot of Flight 11, he was the ringleader of the whole operation. So they probably would have had to call off the whole operation that they had been planning allegedly for 2 years, just because they needed to go to Portland for something, or maybe one last fling. there was an extra good lap dancer up in Portland. I don't know, but that's what they did. And you read that all in. So, but the 9/11 Commission admits we couldn't find any reason why they did this. The FBI admits we can't find any reason why they did this. But it turned out to be a good thing they did do it, because after the tower was hit, somebody looks over there and says, hey, Look at that luggage. That's got Muhammad Atta's name on it. Let's open it up and see what's in there. So they look it up, and they find that will I mentioned before. They find flight instructions for flying, you know, 757s and 767s. They find Atta, Quran and words of encouragement to the other hijackers and so on. Now, this was kind of a strange story, too. If you were going to fly your plane, see, the idea was that Otto's luggage didn't make the flight, and that's why they found it there, because he took that commuter flight and somehow luggage didn't make it. If you were going to fly a plane into a building, would you take your will with you? Probably not. But that was the idea that he did. And this became the decisive evidence, because they were already suspecting. You know, George Tenet is clairvoyant. And as soon as this happened, he said, boy, that just sounds like Al-Qaeda. This got Al-Qaeda's fingerprints all over it. But, you know, that was just male intuition. You know how trustworthy that is. And so they needed proof. Well, the luggage was the proof. So that was when they knew it was Al-Qaeda. Because there was a confession. And it's interesting, however, if you go back to September 12th and read the newspapers, here's the story you will read. Muhammad Atta's luggage was found in a white Mitsubishi in Logan parking lot in Boston. Two guys named Bukhari, they assumed they were brothers, had rented a blue Nissan and driven up to Portland, stayed overnight in the Comfort Inn, and then took the 6 o'clock commuter flight back down in time to catch the flight. It wasn't until September 14th, 15th, well, September 14th, they started changing the story because they found a little problem. The Bukharis hadn't died on 9/11. One was still alive and the other one had died a year before. So somebody at the FBI had flunked basic research. So they just changed the story. And so the Bukharis just dropped away, the white Mitsubishi just dropped away after going all around the world. I mean, these were stories in Australia, in England, in Sweden, everywhere. Talked about the white Mitsubishi, where Otto's treasure trove of information was found. Then it just disappears. And now everybody knows Otto went to Portland. But Otto didn't actually go to Portland until September. I think 16th or 17th was when the final version of the story finally got printed by the very trustworthy Washington Post. So here again, you see, they make it, not only make it up if it doesn't work out, they just make up a new story. Now, you might say, and this is always quoted, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. So even though there's no evidence that there were any hijackers on the plane, that doesn't prove they weren't there. You can't prove they weren't on there. Well, actually, we do have evidence of absence. Pilots on these airplanes, most airplanes, certainly these, have a little box for squawking what they call a hijack code. All you have to do is turn some knobs, and it's a universal hijack code, 7500. Takes about 2 to 3 seconds to do that. Now, on these flights, the idea was they were told the hijackers banged their way into the cabin. And on flight 93, there was a lot of banging going on, so there was more than 2 or 3 seconds. And one of the pilots on Flight 11 even got a posthumous medal for heroic, for turning a switch that allowed us to hear Muhammad Atta's voice. And yet, all 8 pilots, the 4 pilots and the 4 co-pilots, none of them turned these buttons to to squawk the hijacked code. Now, you know Sherlock Holmes' famous story about silver blades and the dog that didn't bark. The story was that Silver Blaze was a champion racehorse, and then just before a big race, he disappears. And so the local detective, his theory is that an intruder came in and stole Silver Blaze. Well, Sherlock Holmes says, there's a curious thing about what the dog did that night. And the local inspector says, well, what do you mean? The dog didn't do anything. That's the curious thing. If an intruder had come in, the dog would have barked. And that's how he solved the mystery. There was no intruder. In the planes, the pilots that didn't squawk proved that there were no intruders into the cabins. So we do have evidence of absence. That, by the way, is not in any of these books. That'll be in a future book. But it's such a good story, I wanted to throw it in. Then if you read the 9/11 Commission report, you find that Vice President Cheney got down there almost 10 o'clock, perhaps 9:58. Well, that was pretty late. Pentagon had already been hit at 9:37, 9:38, according to the official story. And Flight 93 was almost ready to crash, because according to the official story, it crashed at 10:03. And there was a lot of controversy about, did it get shot down? Did the U.S. military shoot it down? Because people around there said the plane got shot down. I mean, that tended to give people a thought. And one of the pilots who got back to Otis Air Force Base, he said when he got back to the base, he heard that one of our planes had shot down the plane over Pennsylvania. So there were a lot of rumors about this. And but Cheney not getting to the bunker till about 10 o'clock, so by the time he got in there and, you know, got organized, the plane would have been crashed already. So he couldn't have given the order to shoot it down. In fact, the 9/11 Commission tells us that he didn't get around to giving the shoot-down order till 10:15. However, if you go back to the 9/11 Commission hearing, Norman Mineta, on March 23rd, 2003, in open testimony, on TV, you can watch this on YouTube, reported that he got to the White House about 9:15 that morning, went in to see Richard Clark, the counterterrorism star, who was just ready to start his video conference. And the Clark told him, you should go on down to the PIOC and join the vice president. And Clark tells the same story in his book, Against All Enemies, a book that is not mentioned once in the 9/11 Commission report, even though it became a national bestseller while the 9/11 Commission was in session. It happens that Philip Zelikow, who wrote the 9/11 Commission report, you think it's Tom Kane and Lee Hamilton? No, Philip Zelikow, who's essentially a member of the White House, was the executive director of the commission, and he took charge of everything. They hate each other. Zelikow had come in and reorganized, helped Condi Rice when she became the National Security Advisor under the new President Bush, helped her make suggestions, and one of them was that Richard Clark should be demoted. And Richard Clark's book says all sorts of things that contradicted in advance what the 9/11 Commission was going to say. So between those two facts, it's no mystery that the 9/11 Commission does not even mention that Richard Clark's book exists. But it does, and millions of people have read it, and in there it says that that Mineta came in about then, and he told him to go on down. And so Mineta said he got down there about 9:20, and of course the vice president was already there, and he reported this conversation that he overheard. Well, I mean, he was right next to him. He couldn't help it. The young man kept coming in the room, and he'd say, Mr. Vice President, that plane is now 50 miles out. He'd come back in. Now it's 30 miles out. Come back in. Now it's 10 miles out, do the order still stand? And Cheney whipped his neck around and said, of course the order still stands. Have you heard anything different? I can't do it like John Stewart, so I don't even try to change his voice. It sounded like the confirmation of a stand-down order. Now, Mineta said he thought it was a shoot-down order. But, of course, nothing was shot down there. This is before the Pentagon. He's very clear about that. Mineta later said, well, I may have been wrong about that. He was pressed to say, well, about what time that would have been, about 9:25 or 9:26. He later said, well, I might have been wrong with that, but it's definitely before the Pentagon was hit. So what did the 9/11 Commission do with Mineta's testimony? They completely omitted it. No reference to it in the 9/11 Commission report. My second book, of course, was called The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. This is one of the 115 lies of omission and distortion that I cataloged. And that if I were writing it now, I'd have way over 200 of them. It was not only Mineta. Other people, David Bohr, Cheney's own photographer, said that Cheney went down. The Secret Service guys came in and took him down shortly after 9 o'clock. Condoleezza Rice on an ABC show is shown supporting this. So there was no controversy about this, but it was just too dangerous to have Cheney down there. So the 9/11 Commission report just changed the time that he went downstairs by about 45 minutes. So the 9/11 Commission felt pretty bold to contradict all these people. And really, really bold, they contradicted Dick Cheney himself. This is my newest article. I just published it the other day after Tim Russert died, the well-known host of Meet the Press on NBC. And 5 days after 9/11, Russert came up to Camp David and interviewed Dick Cheney in a memorable interview. And during this interview, Cheney said, they talked about other things, and then Russert said, well, you know, tell us about what you did that morning. So Cheney went through what his morning was like. And he reported that the Secret Service guys came in to his office and picked him up. Pretty dramatic story about, you know, they're really big guys and I'm not so tall, so my feet barely hit the ground. And they take me downstairs and take me into the corridor that leads to the PIOC at the other end. And I stopped and I phoned the president. And then I walked on down to the PIOC. And shortly thereafter, we got word the Pentagon's been hit. So we got the sequence. Gets to the PIOC, then here's the Pentagon's been hit. Read the 9/11 Commission. Here's what happened. There was a plane coming in that motivated the Secret Service, but it turned away, so they didn't take him down then. They waited till 9:36 to take him down. He didn't enter the corridor until 9:37. He went in and made his phone call to the president, but it took a very long time to get through to the president. You know how these presidential phones, everybody's calling him, and the vice president wouldn't be able to get through. And so it took a long time, and while he was there, he was told the Pentagon's been hit. And he turned on the TV and watched the smoke from the Pentagon. And then finally got through to the president, and he has a very long conversation with him. Then his wife comes, Lynn Cheney comes, and then they both walk into the PIOC about 9:58. So here you have an absolute contradiction between what the 9/11 Commission says and what Vice President Cheney himself said 5 days after 9/11, when presumably his memory was pretty fresh. You can read this if you want to read the whole detail. It's called Tim Russert, Dick Cheney, and 9/11. It's on Michelle's website, Global Research. Which is one of the best websites in the world, by the way, if you don't know that. I finally figured out how to get applause so I could get a drink. Thank you. By the way, if anybody has to go home, just go. It won't hurt my feelings. I know I sometimes have to leave early. Okay. How about the Pentagon? The official story about it, true. What is the official story? It's that Hani Hanyur flew, the hijackers took over the flight, and remember they got all pushed to the back, and Hani's up in the cabin. And he flies this plane back to Washington, D.C., without any help from the ground crew, of course. And then when he gets there, he comes in and does an amazing spiral. He's up at 8,000 feet, and he's got to get down there, and so he does a spiral, 333-degree downward spiral, which he descended 8,000 feet, and then brought that plane in and hit the Pentagon in the first floor. Virtually all the people who were killed on the first or the second floor. So it hits it between the first and the second floor without scratching the lawn, even though the engines stick down below the wings. This was some pilot. In fact, the day after 9/11, people were saying, this guy, he must have been first of all, they said it must have been a military plane just looking at the radar. And but no, it was a Boeing 757. And they said it must have been an expert pilot. Hani Hanyur was not that. He, about a month and a half before 9/11, he was trying to take training in a single-engine plane. And the instructor refused to go up with him a second time. He said, it's too dangerous. This was a universal opinion. Even the New York Times had quoted one of his instructors saying, I'm amazed he was able to do that. He couldn't fly at all. So this story by itself disproves the official story. You know, we have an organization now called Pilots for 9/11 Truth. So you've got former military pilots, former 757 and 767 pilots. And they say, you know, like Russ Wittenberg says, I was flying these things for 35 years after being a military pilot. I couldn't have done that. I know a guy, you know, it takes years to go from small planes to medium-sized planes. And then even from a small plane up to a 757 or the Big Bird, 767, the Big Birds, takes months and months of training and certification and all that. The idea that a guy who had never successfully flown a Cessna could have jumped in one of these planes and even gotten it back to Washington, let alone doing this fabulous downward spiral and coming in at ground level. And there are all sorts of other reasons. It was just physically impossible for a 757 to do that maneuver, no matter who was at the thing. But just by the story. So you could, even if you said, well, maybe they were wrong about Hani Hanyur, maybe it was one of the other guys. No, nobody, none of those guys could have done that. Secondly, what part of the Pentagon did it hit? This is the most important part of the story. What would have been the motive? It hit Wedge 1. Why would... You know, these hijackers, they were people who hated America and hated Americans because they hated our freedoms. And they particularly hated the military, which was doing bad things in Muslim countries. And, of course, that's no joke. We have had already before 9/11. So why would they have picked Wedge 1, which was as far away from the auspices of Donald Rumsfeld and all the top brass as you could get? Wedge 1's over here, they're over here. So there was no danger to their lives. Secondly, Wedge 1 was the only part of the Pentagon that had been renovated, in which you put extra strong facing on it and fireproofing. And so any other part of the Pentagon would have done far more damage than Wedge 1. Wedge 1 would have been the last place. These terrorists were really smart. They were smart enough to outfox the most sophisticated air defense system in history. You think they didn't know where Dick where Donald Rumsfeld's office was. You don't think they knew this is the only part of the Pentagon that had been reinforced? You don't think they knew that because it was still being reinforced, the work was still going? There were very few employees there. So only 125, that's bad enough. But had they hit anywhere else in the Pentagon, they could have killed several hundred or even thousands of people. They would not have hit Wedge 1. There's a theory as to what was going on in Wedge 1. Now, Barbara Honecker has an essay on it at the back of Tim Marr's new edition of his book, which has something to do with the $2.3 trillion that Cheney had announced the day before 9/11 that, oops, it's missing. The story cards got completely buried by 9/11. And the part of the Pentagon that was hit was where the people who, and the computers that would have been checking about that money were. So this looked like it's a very deliberate act of murdering these particular people. The whole 9/11 thing is very gruesome when you think about it. Every detail of it is gruesome. This one is particularly so. Why was there no evacuation of the Pentagon? Why were 125 people killed? They said, well, we had no idea this plane was coming. You know, it had been just a half hour going from the Midwest back towards the Pentagon. Everybody knew, everybody was saying, you know, it hit the World Trade Center. Surely the Pentagon's next. They even had a bar they called Ground Zero. So why wasn't it evacuated? Because they said we had no idea this thing was coming. Well, this last year, CNN, for some reason, revealed that the most sophisticated military control and communication plane in the world, the E-4B, was flying over the White House, which is just a couple miles from the Pentagon, at the time the Pentagon was hit. This E-4B is known as the Flying Pentagon. If the Pentagon ever would get struck, they could still command all of our forces, all of our nuclear forces, from one of these planes. And so here it is, not very high, just over the White House. And yet nobody knew that it took this 3.5 minutes for this plane to spiral the Pentagon and come down in 3 minutes and 10 seconds, I think. A lot of people could have gotten out. Certainly all the people on the first floor who got killed could have been evacuated. So they did deliberately murder these people. Bush in Florida, I mentioned. Why was he in Florida? Well, he was there to advertise his, publicize his new economic policy. His new education policy. No child left behind. Based on his economic policy, no billionaire left behind. And so he got to the school. And then he hears that, oh, a plane has hit the World Trade Center, what a terrible accident, we'll do the reading thing anyway. So he goes in, listens to these second graders read this book about their pet goat. And a few minutes after, the second tower is hit at 9:03. So a couple of minutes later, Andy Card, his chief of staff, comes in, whispers in his ear, second World Trade Center tower has been hit, America's under attack. That's what he told us later, he said. And, of course, Bush sprung into action, right? No, if you've seen Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, you know he sat there, and he sat there, and he sat there. Now, many people say, well, who would expect Bush to know what to do? That's a good point. But the Secret Service knew what to do. They're very well rehearsed. Their whole mission is to save the president's life. If there's a bullet coming, they jump in front of the bullet, you know. And standard operating procedure is they always have a pre-established secret location. You rush the president to if there's any sign of danger to his life. They didn't do that. They sat there. Now, there was one guy, the guy who carried his special telephone, saw that second plane hit the tower. He said, we're out of here. But he was a low-ranking agent. Obviously got overruled by the lead secret agent. And what does that tell you? You know, the Globe and Mail had a story that said, why wasn't Bush bustled away? What does it suggest? It suggested the Secret Service knew there was no danger. But there should have been, if the official story were true, if that was a surprise attack, and at that time there were seven or more planes that were thought to have been hijacked, they should have assumed, here they're going after high-value targets, what would be a higher value target than the President of the United States? All they had to do was crash into that school. They killed the President, all the people in the school, and incidentally, all the Secret Service agents. Those agents would have gotten out of there so fast if that had been a real surprise attack. But they didn't. When the 9/11 Commission asked him, why'd you leave Bush in the room? I said, well, we kind of wanted to get him out of there, but we didn't think we had to run him out of the room. And nobody said, well, you know, there might have been something between running him out of the room and leaving him there for another 20 minutes, like walking him out of the room. You know, if decorum was an important factor. And that's what Bush said later. Oh, I didn't want to frighten the children. No, it'd be better to have him incinerated. So then what did the White House do on the first anniversary of 9/11? It finally occurred to one of those geniuses, that was a bad plan. So they said, we should have had Bush just get up and walk out of the room. So let's just change the story. So Andrew Card wrote a story for the San Francisco Chronicle. He went on MSNBC with Brian Williams. He went on, he and Carl Rove went on ABC with Charlie Gibson. And they told this new story that Andy said, I whispered in the presidential ear, and he sat there just for a second or two. And he got up and excused himself and said, excuse me, I have to go. And he left. Just changed the story. Now, this was 2002. Michael Moore's movie didn't come out until 2004. Hardly anybody had seen it. It didn't even surface on the internet until 2003. And they thought they could get away with it. And they would have, probably without Michael Moore. So you're getting the idea here. They're just lying on every single thing. Michelle mentioned, you know, when I was writing my report on the 9/11 Commission study, somebody said, have you found anything untrue in there? I said, the challenge is to find anything that is true. It is just a lot. I've got an essay that's called The 9/11 Commission Report, a 571-page lie. It is just a lie from the very first page to the very last page. Okay, well, I've got some other things I was going to tell you, but I'll stop. I'll just tell you what I was going to tell you. I was going to tell you about World Trade Center buildings and why the official story absolutely cannot be true. A little problem with Newton's laws of motion and, you know, basic laws of physics. Little factors like of the 503 fire members of the fire department of New York who gave oral testimony, and they weren't asked any questions. They just said, tell what you heard that day. 118 of them report, another Canadian reported this. 118 of them gave very graphic descriptions of explosions going off in the building. And I brought the book up here. I was going to read you a bunch of these. So if somebody in the Q&A says, why don't you read a couple of those, I might. other factors in there that show that it couldn't be the official story. The official story is, of course, the planes came in, hit the buildings, caused some damage, and then fire started. The fires got very hot, heated up the steel till it lost strength. And then the top part of the building, above that hole, crawled by the planes, fell down the lower part and then caused the lower part to just crumble. Now, these buildings came down at virtually threefold speed. So it was like those lower floors with their 287 columns that went from the sub-basement, steel columns from the sub-basements through the roof, didn't exist. The building had, you know, they put out this story, these were hollow tubes. No, had 47 core columns that were like this big around at the base, and then they taper up, taper off as you go up. And this is the problem with Newton's law of the conservation of momentum. If you hit, let's say you're in your little sports car and you hit a semi, can you imagine that semi that stopped at a light is just going to start going down the freeway about as fast as your little sports car was going? No, that's the conservation of momentum. There has to be some resistance. In these buildings, there was no resistance. Furthermore, in Building 7, there was no plane. So you didn't have any of this dynamic. You didn't have big fires going. You had fires on three or four floors at most. 47-story building had 81 steel columns. The building comes, you can see it on TV. You'll never see it on mainstream TV, but if you go on YouTube, you can see this, or any of the good, you know, films about this. 9/11 Mysteries, you've seen, have you? That's a good one for this. Loose Change, Final Cut. I happen to be the script consultant for it, so I happen to know that everything in it is accurate. And you can see the buildings in there, and so on. To come down vertically, a completely symmetrical collapse, that takes the best demolition companies in the world. There are only a handful of companies that can do that. And yet, allegedly on 9/11, three buildings came straight down symmetrically as if all their steel columns had been cut. Furthermore, you had steel that was melted. Steel, I'll talk Fahrenheit. Steel doesn't begin to melt until 2800 degrees Fahrenheit. The hottest building fire in the world could not get over 1800 degrees, probably not over 1400 degrees Fahrenheit. So you're at least 1,000 degrees away from the possibility of melting steel. And yet, people said steel was flowing down there like lava. You had an enormous amount of steel that was melted. You had a story in the New York Times about the greatest mystery uncovered, that some of the steel columns had been oxidized. So they were very thin, and they looked like cheese with the holes in them. And they were sulfidized. Sulfur is what you add to certain explosives like thermite to make the melting point of steel much, much lower. Stephen Jones has discovered residue of thermite in ground zero dust and so on. Finally, last point that I was going to come to is that the story is now so much stronger than it was just a couple years ago. Because a few years ago, they could dismiss the 9/11 truth movement as a bunch of loony conspiracy theorists, you know, a bunch of kids on the internet. And then I joined and wrote some books, and they said a bunch of kids on the internet and an aging theologian. You know, we don't know anything about the real world. But now, you've got veterans for 9/11 truth, pilots for 9/11 truth, architects and engineers for 9/11 truth. You have former CIA analysts who have joined the movement, some who've endorsed my books and so on. So we've got a lot of people with the relevant kinds of professional expertise. And so, you know, if you read Popular Mechanics, they like to say, oh, all the experts support the official story. Find how many names you can find it. They just say all these experts. They name about four or five. We've now got, you know, we're in the hundreds or thousands. Already 400 people within a year, architects and engineers, have signed up, put their name on the public record demanding a new examination of the official story. So all the movement is in our direction. You don't find conversions the other way. You don't find people who say, oh yeah, I used to believe the alternative theory, but I've decided after scrutinizing the evidence that the official story makes the most sense. This is a well-known principle of irreversibility. Movement can only go one way. You know, it's like starting with a bad wine. You think it's a pretty good wine. You learn, that there are better wines. You can never go back to thinking Mogan David was a great wine. I know this. I learned this from my own experience. So it's the same thing here. You can never go back to the official story once you know the alternative evidence against the official story. Well, thank you very much.
Questions. I'd like to say something about this wine, the wine. Because in the last, actually it's not wine, it's Johnny Walker Black Label. And I think most people know what I'm talking about. David Ray Griffin has given us a very detailed analysis of the lies behind 9/11, but in fact, the British, who are supposed to be smarter than the Americans, they're not. There's no actual proof to that effect. But when they planned the liquid bomb attacks a few years ago, which was a very dramatic event which never took place, and they had this conspiracy of five terrorists who would be boarding five planes simultaneously to explode them in midair somewhere across the Atlantic, out of Heathrow Airport, London, which is sprawling with security guards and customs officials and so on. And it was based on the declaration of the Home Secretary, how well planned this operation was, etc., etc. And they immediately initiated a big operation in London and Heathrow, and everybody lost their holidays in the process. And it turned out and it was confirmed in the small print of Newsweek magazine that these alleged mastermind terrorists didn't have tickets and boarding passes, and some of them didn't have passports to board the aircraft. Okay? And this is acknowledged. I mean, I don't think they even changed the story there. It was acknowledged. There was never any, and I understand there wasn't any actual investigation or indictment or whatever, but today that lie still prevails. Namely, when you board the aircraft, your drinking water is, and your wine and your scotch and everything is confiscated, and the only way you can actually bring booze back to Canada is if you don't have a connecting flight. So into Montreal is all right. But what I'm saying there is that these 9/11, this 9/11 ritual of lying, have been replicated in a number of other events. I won't go into any detail. The other very important terrorist attack, which was dramatic and happened, was the Bali bomb attack in 2002. Now, the former president of Indonesia, President Wahid, went on to Australian public television in a long interview, and he said, we have the transcripts, I put up the transcripts before they took them down from the Australian public television network, and he said that one of the Bali bomb attacks was the work of the police and the military. Okay? So that's the former head of state. Now, one would expect that any self-respecting journalist or media would do one of two things. Either they say, this fellow doesn't know what he's talking about, there's been an investigation, the president is an absolute idiot. Okay? So that's one reaction. Or the more, perhaps the less radical one would say, well, he's after all, he's the president of the country, and it took place when he was in office, etc., etc. And maybe we should look into the statement made by a former head of state. Now, they did neither of these things. What they did is that within 2 days, I think this was a live interview, within two or three days of the interview, the transcripts were removed from the website of Australian Public Television, and the thing was simply vanished from any kind of discussion as to the causes of the Bali bombing. And then you had some fake investigation by Australian and US investigators which covered the whole thing up. So what I'm saying is we're dealing with the whole range of falsehoods. I mean, we could talk about those chemical, we could talk about Colin Powell's statement to the United Nations on February 5th, 2003, which was the smoking gun, and where the report that he submitted, he said, well, here's the report prepared by the British. Of course, the British are smart, okay? British intelligence report, here it is, gentlemen of the Security Council, fabulous report. It wasn't prepared by the British Secret Service, it was prepared by two journalists in the public relations office of Tony Blair, etc. And what did they do? It was mentioned on Channel 4. We've covered it on our website. I have a section in an appendix in my book. It was plagiarized, copied and pasted off the internet. It was a student's report, dated, and then it said it was the weapons of mass destruction that Saddam Hussein has had, and they copied and pasted it off the internet, put it onto the report of the British, so-called British Secret Service report, presented to the United Nations Security Council with all the punctuation mistakes, etc. It was revealed by a professor, Glenn Rangwala, at Cambridge University, and he said he looked at it like some of us do when we get, you know, students' papers that seem to have read this before. But it was the other way around. It was Colin Powell that was plagiarizing a student rather than a student plagiarizing Colin Powell. So there you are, that the casus belli for invading Iraq was an authoritative intelligence report which was plagiarized off a student in Southern California. It was the Monterey Institute or whatever. And there he was saying, well, we think that the chemical weapons up in northern Iraq, etc., etc. And then afterwards, when the journalists entered into northern Iraq, they said the only thing we found was cooking oil. Now, that was confirmed in a British press report. So what we're seeing here is that the lies are so extensive, and they extend. Of course, they extend into the war theaters as to what's going on, to the tortures, to the figures on death, on casualties, on the torturing of people in Guantanamo, and that is why 9/11 is so important, because it is the deck of cards, and we have to make that deck of cards collapse because then the war criminals in high office do not have a leg to stand on. Their main smoking gun and casus belli has vanished. We are going to open up the question period. It has to be done with utmost order and respect.
I have two questions. Yes, sir. Are you suggesting that the pilots who drove the planes into the buildings were committing suicide? They were in on the conspiracy? I mean, I don't quite understand. And all those supposedly hijackers who were studying how to fly planes, what was that all about? I don't understand, because there's something that... And it seems to me that what is important to me is to find out who is the mastermind behind all this. It's the corporations who want all this to happen so that they can rule the world with impunity.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for those questions, because it's a huge story, and so you've got the official story, and my major focus is on why the official story isn't true. But then that raises the question, well, then what really did happen? And a lot of those things I just don't know, but on some things I have a hunch, so I'll give you my hunches. I suspect the planes were taken over technologically and flown by remote control. The planes may have even been switched. The flight 175, the transponder goes off right when it's over Griffith Air Force Base in Rome, New York. So this is the center of a lot of this technological innovation. So there probably were no suicide pilots, Muslim or otherwise. Whether these were the actual planes, certainly Flight 77 did not hit the Pentagon. Whether Flight 11 and 175 hit the buildings, there's more debate on that, but quite likely not. It's not something I've discussed. But technological control of aircraft has been possible for a long time, and flying by remote control. So that's what I suspect happened. And the alleged hijackers were most likely patsies. They probably thought they were participating in some operation, but didn't know exactly what. Some people think they were running drugs. Otta, while he was supposed to be a flight school student, was already quite an expert pilot, and evidently was taking flights to the south from Florida. So there are a lot of things we don't know, but we could find out very quickly if we had a real investigation. So that's what we're calling for. But certainly it's helpful to have some at least possible alternative explanations as to what really happened.
Hello, my name is Bernie Pearson. I'm with Architects and Engineers for the Truth. I was going to ask about the E-4B over Washington, because there have been reports for many years about a white plane overhead, and that sounds like a likely candidate. I was also going to mention something that's worthwhile considering, is that the avionics and controls of a 757 and 767 are identical. When a pilot is checked out on one, they're checked out on the other automatically. And so it's reasonable to assume the technological takeover of one would also work on the other. I was going to ask.
Okay, let me speak on the E-4B. This was shown on TV, and they can blow this up, and there's just absolutely no doubt about what it was, because it's got the distinctive hump that no other plane has. They had a military guy, John King, on CNN, had a military guy there and said, definitely, I mean, no doubt about it whatsoever. But the Pentagon denies it. They deny that it's one of their aircraft. So you know, if they're going to give such a blatant lie, they're covering something big up. Just like if they're going to tell such a blatant lie about Dick Cheney, you know Dick Cheney was right in the center of things on that day. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
The presentation just given by David Ray Griffin on 9/11 Contradictions, an open letter to Congress and the press, his latest of 5 books critiquing the government version of the events of 9/11. David Ray Griffin is a professor emeritus of theology and philosophy from the Claremont Graduate School in Southern California. You can download an MP3 of this and previous episodes of the show at unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.